Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, 14th Amendment, Right to Keep and Bear Arms Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 2, 2010, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in McDonald v. City of Chicago. The question in this case is whether the Due Process Clause or the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment makes the right to keep and bear arms applicable to the states. To discuss the case, we have Clark Neely, who is a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice and signed an amicus brief in support of McDonald, and we have Marquette University Law School professor J. Gordon Hilton, who is on an amicus brief in support of the City of Chicago, Northwestern University School of Law George C. Dix professor Stephen Calabresi moderates the discussion. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now I will turn this over to Professor Calabresi.
This is a Federalist Society podcast following the oral argument in Otis McDonald et al. Against City of Chicago, Illinois et al. Yesterday. The main issue in the case is whether an ordinance adopted by the City of Chicago regulating gun possession and ownership is constitutional, and in particular whether the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is incorporated to apply against states and localities by the 14th Amendment. We have with us to discuss this Mr. Clark Neely from the Institute for Justice, who is a proponent of the position that the Second Amendment is incorporated against the states and that it bans the Chicago ordinance in this case. And on the other side, Professor Gordon Hilton from Marquette, who will advance arguments in defense of the City of Chicago's regulation. We will begin with Mr. Neely and then hear from Professor Hilton, and then at the end, each of them will respond to what the other had to say. So let's begin then with Clark Neely.
Well, thank you, Professor Calabresi, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having us on. It's a very important and hopefully very interesting topic. As most of the listeners probably know, the McDonald case is basically a follow-on to the 2008 Supreme Court decision in District of Columbia v. Heller, which was the case in which the Supreme Court held for the first time that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms, or at least to keep arms in the home for lawful self-defense. But that left open a very interesting and very important question, which is whether the right to arms also applies against state and local governments. And of course, the District of Columbia, being a federal jurisdiction, is bound directly by the Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment. But states are not. States are only bound by the 14th Amendment, which has been held over the years to incorporate most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights and make them enforceable against state and local governments, with one very notable exception, namely the right to keep and bear arms. So that was the question that was presented in the McDonald case, and it involves basically a very similar law in Chicago to the one that was struck down in D.C., namely what is effectively a ban on all handguns and very significant restrictions on the ability to own long guns. And so that was the issue presented to the court. Yesterday's arguments, I would say, were very encouraging if all you care about is the likely result. Most people seem to agree that the justices signaled that they were very clearly leaning towards incorporating or making enforceable the right to at least own guns at home for self-defense and make that enforceable against state and local governments under the 14th Amendment. I think the arguments were actually quite discouraging, unfortunately, if you care about the process or the integrity of the court's reasoning in reaching that result, because the justices indicated that they were inclined to make the right to keep arms at home enforceable against the states through a doctrine called substantive due process, which, as most people know, is essentially a doctrine that was pressed into service by the Supreme Court beginning in the early part of the 20th century to essentially carry the weight of this incorporation doctrine and to make various rights applicable against the states. But it's very controversial. Some people don't think that it makes any sense at all to talk about substantive due process. Other people agree that it has at least some historical legitimacy or pedigree, but that it's not the best means of making enforceable various individual rights against the states. I fall into the latter camp. I think it's quite clear that both the framers and the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment intended to protect a fairly broad set of individual rights, and I think it's also clear that they intended to do that through the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment and not the Due Process Clause. And if you basically, you know, want to try to get a sense of what rights they intended to protect at the time, you really have to look at the history and the context in which the 14th Amendment was ratified. And the thing I think that was most surprising about the arguments in McDonald yesterday was the complete lack of interest from any justice on the court, as far as we could tell, sitting there in the audience, in that question. Basically, there was no question from any of the justices that I can recall about what was going on at the time the 14th Amendment was ratified, what was on the minds of the people who wrote it, what were some of the issues that were going back and forth. And that was very odd because the history is so important. And think about the extent to which history and originalism played a role in both the majority and dissenting opinions in Heller. There was essentially an originalist duel between Justice Scalia writing for the majority and Justice Stevens in the principal dissent that really centered on the history of the Second Amendment. And that was completely absent during the oral arguments in McDonald yesterday. And the history is even more clear for the 14th Amendment than it was for the Second Amendment. It involves a terrible, awful history of lynching, of terror in the Reconstruction South, and abundant evidence of both newly freed blacks and white unionists being systematically disarmed to make them more vulnerable to Southern terror and reprisals. And it was amazing to me, listening to the arguments of McDonald, that none of that history was discussed and that not one justice showed any interest in it. And if they had, it would have significantly focused, in my opinion, the argument over both the existence and the scope of the individual right to keep and bear arms as it applies against state and local governments, because that is one of the things that was mentioned more often during the ratification of the 14th Amendment than any other right. I'll leave it at that, but just basically to sum up, it was extraordinary during the arguments of McDonald to note the contrast between the justices' basically complete lack of interest in the relevant history in McDonald, but as compared to the very strong interest they seem to have in history with respect to Heller.
Thank you. Professor Hilton?
Well, thank you very much, and I also appreciate the Federalist Society for giving me the opportunity to participate in this discussion. I certainly agree with Mr. Neely that the oral arguments yesterday, although I was not there in person, at least my reading of them, or at least of the accounts, were disappointing in that the court did show such little interest in history as a source of information or illumination for answering this question. So I certainly also believe that the historical record has the capacity to illuminate these questions a great deal. However, I think I read the historical record differently than Mr. Neely. So I want to just offer some very general observations of what I see as the kind of central problem here. First, in regard particularly to this question, does the Second Amendment apply to the states through the 14th Amendment? Of course, anyone who's ever read the Second Amendment notes how peculiarly worded it is, particularly in contrast to the other portions of the Bill of Rights. I think the central problem is that the Second Amendment itself does not really say anything about it, specifically about the individual right to gun ownership for protection, for self-protection, or for hunting. Even though some of the Revolutionary era and early national state constitutions addressed those things specifically, I don't think the Second Amendment was intended to say there was no such right, but the Second Amendment, it seems to me, was clearly addressing the question of whether or not the national government would have the power to eliminate the state militias or to hamper the ability of states to respond to tyranny. That had been, of course, an issue during the Revolutionary era. The Scots were not permitted to have their own militia under English law. The English game laws, which severely restricted individual rights of gun ownership, were nominally about protecting wild animals, but, of course, were often criticized as really being just a way of subtly disarming the public. So I think one thing, just conceptually, there's a problem of incorporating the language of the Second Amendment through the 14th and having it have it come out as a kind of individualized right of gun ownership for self-protection or for hunting. Now, on the other hand, I believe that most Americans in the late 18th century, throughout the 19th century and into the 20th, understood or believed that they had a kind of constitutional right, if you will, to gun ownership for self-protection and hunting. But I think it's harder to kind of locate that sort of broad cultural sense of right into any particular textual aspect of the Constitution. I also wanted to say just a word or two about these issues that Mr. Neely raised regarding the Reconstruction experience with firearms. Obviously, there's an enormous literature on what the 14th Amendment meant, and it's clear that the 14th Amendment meant different things to different people. And it's not clear that there was any kind of broad consensus among the people who voted for it in Congress or who voted to ratify it in the states as to precisely what it meant beyond a kind of commitment to a sort of generalized equal protection, that that African Americans were entitled to the same protection under the laws as whites were. And the 14th Amendment clearly established that. But beyond that, it's harder to say. The Reconstruction's experience with gun laws, I think, actually raises this problem. The problem wasn't that the southern states were attempting to disarm everyone. The problem was that the white governments in the southern states immediately after the Civil War were prohibiting African Americans from owning firearms while permitting whites to own firearms. And then even once there are black militias established, then there's this concerted effort on the part of the Ku Klux Klan and elsewhere to try to disarm the black militias. But, of course, they're not trying to disarm white militias. They're not trying to disarm themselves. So, again, I think the more one looks at the experience surrounding Reconstruction, really the more this gun issue is really involves a question of equal protection rather than a question of individual rights of ownership. But all that said, it seems to me that the central constitutional question in this case is that what are the limitations, if any, on the ability of the states to impose reasonable restrictions on the ownership of firearms? I think if one can read the historical record, because whether or not the Second Amendment applied directly to the states, every state to some extent or another recognized a right to own firearms, even for purposes of self-protection or hunting, but that right was always understood to be subject to reasonable state regulations under the police power, and occasionally that included even the banning of certain categories of weapons. Dodge City, Kansas, for example, in the 19th century, had a municipal ordinance that prohibited people from bringing guns into the town limits, you know, as a way of trying to regulate violence. So it seems to me that ultimately the sort of central constitutional question in McDonnell is not whether or not there is a right to firearms, because I think that, or a right to own guns generally, because I think that I agree that that does exist in our system. It's the question of whether or not the Chicago restrictions in the context in which they're adopted fall into that large, long historically recognized category of reasonable restraints on the right. So I guess I'll conclude my initial comments there.
I think we agreed that each of you would have a minute or two just to quickly respond to the other. Mr. Neely, did you want to say something?
Sure.
In response?
So this is Clark Neely. I strongly disagree with Professor Hilton on a couple of points. Most importantly, I think it is historically inaccurate to say that the 14th Amendment was only concerned about equal protection or that that's the only thing that was clearly protected. Some of the most powerful evidence for that comes, for example, from the fact that before the Civil War, it was illegal throughout the South for whites and blacks to advocate abolition. So that was a law that applied equally to whites and blacks, but it was disastrous for blacks, and an equal protection provision would not have protected what needed to be protected, which was free expression, and specifically the ability to speak freely about abolition. And that translates really into the post-Civil War era with Reconstruction. So just to take one example, from the brief that Professor Hilton signed on to, there was a Tennessee law that was enacted in 1879 that said that you could only own an Army or Navy pistol and all other pistols were forbidden. Well, that seems like an even-handed or racially neutral law on its face, but it wasn't. Those kinds of laws were specifically passed to try to make sure that black people couldn't have pistols because the Army or Navy pistol was a more expensive model that they would be unlikely to be able to afford. So you have overtly unequal laws, and you have laws that are unequal only when you see how they actually apply, and an equal protection provision would not have protected blacks as much as it needed to. Second point is that it is not true that southern states were only disarming blacks in the wake of the Civil War. They were also disarming white unionists. So again, a kind of a racial equal protection provision was not what the framers of the 14th Amendment were getting at. And they talked over and over again on the floor of the Senate and elsewhere about the importance of the right to keep and bear arms. Those references are just strewn throughout the congressional globe. And so I think it's very difficult to say that the people who were ratifying the 14th Amendment intended it only as an equal protection provision. I'll make one point about reasonableness and then continue that in a later comment. Reasonableness is in the eye of the beholder, and to basically put in the hands of a court the ability to just sort of decide what's reasonable and what's not is never really going to resolve anything, because people who are inclined to be sympathetic to a particular law will always find that it's reasonable, and people who don't like that law will generally find that it is unreasonable. So I'm very uncomfortable with reasonableness as a constitutional standard, but I will get into that in a later comment.
Thank you. Professor Hilton?
Sure, just a very quick comment. I may have not made my point clearly. I was not trying to suggest that the 14th Amendment was intended only to advance an equal protection principle. My point I was trying to make is that there were many different views of what the 14th Amendment protected and didn't protect among those who supported its ratification. What I was trying to suggest is the only common denominator appears to have been a kind of general commitment to the broad concept of equal protection. Beyond that, depending on whose version of the 14th Amendment you're examining, what the amendment means varies from individual supporter to individual supporter. I also think that Mr. Neely's two examples about the disarming of white unionists in the Tennessee gun law, which was really just a kind of not very clever way of trying to arm former Confederates but not permit former slaves to have guns, actually both sort of make the equal protection point. That if you're going to have gun laws, they have to apply. If you're going to have guns, I think it would have been unthinkable in the 19th century to propose a law banning guns across the board in any state. You just can't imagine anyone ever proposing that in the 19th century. So, I mean, again, it seems to me, at least in these Reconstruction examples, the real problem is that the state is favoring one group in regard to firearm rights at the expense of other groups.
There are a number of interesting points to follow up on here, but maybe a good place to start would be to ask each of you what your theory of incorporation of the Bill of Rights through the 14th Amendment is. Bulk of the Bill of Rights has already been incorporated. Some have criticized that as having been illegitimate. Others, on the other hand, like Akhil Amar, have defended incorporation and have urged that the Second Amendment and the right to civil jury trial and the right to a grand jury be incorporated. I was wondering if each of you could state briefly whether you think incorporation was right or wrong, whether it's the whole Bill of Rights that's incorporated, whether there are other rights that are protected, and in general, what your theory of incorporation is as it bears on this question. Maybe we should start with Clark Neely, since he went first.
Sure, thank you. I think the incorporation metaphor is a very unfortunate one. I think it suggests, for example, that the 14th Amendment is sort of like this, you know, mechanical arm that grabs amendments out of the Bill of Rights and just drops them down a chute, and then they become enforceable. And that's not my view of the 14th Amendment at all. I think the 14th Amendment clearly stands on its own, and it protects a set of rights that the set of rights that it protects is informed by what's in the Bill of Rights, but it's not a kind of a mechanistic or jot-for-jot, quote-unquote, incorporation process. Instead, the 14th Amendment, by its terms, protects the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Now, I personally think that that includes most of what's in the Bill of Rights, but not necessarily everything. I think there's a very strong case to be made that some of the procedural protections, like civil jury trials in certain cases and the right to be indicted by a grand jury, are not necessarily privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And I also think it's quite clear that it goes beyond what is in the Bill of Rights, because it would have to in order to protect the kinds of rights that were necessary for freedmen to become full members of society in the wake of the Civil War. These would include things like the ability to enter into contracts, to own property, to move around in search of better economic opportunities. All of those kinds of things would have had to be protected in order to enable freedmen to become full and equal members of society. And in my opinion, that indicates that those are also privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And as I suggested before, one of the rights that was mentioned the most often in connection with the 14th Amendment and the Privileges or Immunities Clause in particular was the right to keep and bear arms. And that is not necessarily because it's mentioned in the Second Amendment. It's because it was an absolutely necessary part of that history. People were being disarmed so they could be lynched, and it was necessary that their right to be armed be protected.
Professor Hilton, do you have a thought on...
I think on this particular question, Mr. Neely and I are more in agreement than different. Also, I have to confess, I think of myself primarily as a historian rather than as a constitutional advocate. So I'm not sure that I have a particular personal theory on incorporation. I think two things are clear. One, and this I think this supports what Mr. Neely was saying, there's an 1884 case called Hurtado versus California. Actually deals with the question of whether or not you can be indicted for a capital crime by information rather than by grand jury, which was the facts in that case. And in that case, the original Justice Harlan makes the argument for total incorporation, and he loses. And this is only 18 years, or 16 years, rather, after the ratification of the 14th Amendment. So certainly everyone on the court who participated in Hurtado had been around during the ratification of the 14th Amendment, and only Justice Harlan thought that the 14th Amendment had explicitly incorporated all of the Bill of Rights protections into its text. I also agree with Mr. Neely that if we could somehow go back in time and start over, it would have been conceptually more logical for the court to focus on the phrase privileges and immunities in the 14th Amendment. But in the Slaughterhouse case in 1873, Justice Samuel Miller specifically rejected that interpretation of privileges and immunities, and that set the court then on the sort of due process course that it's been following ever since. One other just sort of historical note. In 1866, Congress concerned about the oppression of freed blacks in the South by the governments that took the conservative whites who took control immediately after the Civil War, passed the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which guaranteed the right to testify in court, to own property, to quit your job, to move around in search of employment, those kind of basic civil rights. So I think the one thing that is clearly incorporated in the 14th Amendment, which was then enacted to sort of shore up the constitutional basis of this 1866 Civil Rights Act, that I think we can say with confidence the 14th Amendment incorporated. But beyond that, no, I think the historical record, again, is vague. But I would agree with Mr. Neely that I think there was this kind of constitutional commonplace that people in the 19th century assumed that there was a kind of basic right to bear arms.
Let me follow up on that with a question for both of you, which is... I had a chance in writing an article a year and a half ago to look at state constitutions in 1868, and the 37 state constitutions in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, I believe all of them protect a right to civil jury trial, but only about 22 of them protect a right to keep and bear arms. Other rights in the Bill of Rights, like free speech and free exercise of religion, are protected by almost every state. Is there any indication in that, perhaps, that the right to jury trial and the right to free speech and free exercise of religion could be more fundamental than the right to keep and bear arms? And then specifically for Professor Hilton, how much of a right to keep and bear arms do you think was recognized in 1868 that might potentially be applicable to the states today through the 14th Amendment?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I believe that while I agree that there was a right to bear arms separate and apart from the Second Amendment, I think it was in some ways different than other rights because it was so clearly subject to reasonable restrictions. And this had been established even in the pre-Civil War period in the concealed weapon cases that arose in a number of states, primarily in the South, where states had adopted restrictions on the ability to carry certain types of weapons or carry them in a concealed manner. So I think this broadly accepted principle that while there was a right to bear arms, it wasn't absolute, and in fact, to protect the public, the states had sort of considerable leeway in their ability to regulate the ownership of at least certain types of weapons or certain types of firearms. Now, this is purely speculative, but maybe the reason a third of the states don't have a specific clause in their constitution is a result of concern that this right not be overprotected, that the right to impose reasonable regulations not be taken away by a kind of overreading of a state constitutional provision. At least that's my speculation.
I have a question about reasonable regulation of a right to keep and bear arms for both of you, and that is, and many observers of the argument yesterday think it's quite likely the court will recognize some kind of right to keep and bear arms, but also say that reasonable regulation of the right is permissible. That structure of analysis reminds me, as a constitutional law teacher, of Justice Peckham's opinion in Lochner against New York, where he says the 14th Amendment does protect liberty of contract, and freedom to make contracts certainly was an important part of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which both of you have referred to. But Justice Peckham goes on, the states can override liberty of contract through reasonable exercises of the police power. And Justice Peckham then asks whether a 60-hour work week for bakers is a reasonable exercise of the police power or not, and decides that it isn't. Of course, the lesson of the New Deal was that for the court to recognize rights and then evaluate the reasonableness of police power regulations of those rights was to get the courts enmeshed in policymaking and lead them into something that was contrary to the proper functioning of the judiciary. Yet, in this context, it seems as if that may be exactly the direction the court might go in. So I was wondering if either of you, both Mr. Kneeling and Professor Hilton, have a thought about what lessons or relevance that experience in Lochner might have for McDonald versus City of Chicago in terms of recognizing a right, but saying that it can be restricted through a reasonable use of the police power. And maybe we should start with Mr. Neely since he hasn't spoken.
Well, thank you. That's a lot to bite off. Let me see if I can frame it a little bit. I think how a person approaches the issue of reasonableness in constitutional law is informed significantly about how skeptical or not skeptical you are of the government in general. So, for example, you brought up Lochner, and a lot of people don't realize this, but there was no disagreement among the majority and dissenting opinions in Lochner over any fundamental constitutional value. In other words, both sides agreed that there was a right of contract in the Constitution, and that it was an important right. They only disagreed over whether the law at issue, this maximum hours law for bakers in New York, was a valid health and welfare protection on the one hand, which is what the dissenting justices thought, or a rather transparent attempt by established bakers to limit competition against them from new bakers. Now, I happen to believe the latter. I think it's quite clear from the history of Lochner what was going on. That law was lobbied for and passed by established German bakers who were trying to limit the ability of new bakers, primarily Jewish bakers who were new to the United States, from competing with them by putting in extra hours. That's what I think. Now, translating that, for example, to gun laws, if you actually look at the legislative record, for example, in Washington, D.C., which I've done because I was one of the attorneys for the Heller plaintiffs, that law wasn't passed on the basis of any serious deliberation or analysis. In fact, the only quote-unquote evidence that they base the decision to pass the law on is a completely discredited study that no one takes seriously anymore and that the District of Columbia is still citing today. So I think that constitutional rights essentially fall into two basic categories: rights that the Supreme Court is going to protect in some relatively robust fashion, which indicates or would require a certain level of skepticism about stated government motivations and requires the government to demonstrate to some fairly high degree of reliability that they're actually doing something good, on the one hand, or rights that the court is essentially just going to give lip service to and essentially say the government can regulate these activities for any reason or no reason it wants and just on a whim. And I think that the real question in McDonald is going to be which one of those two categories, the right to keep and bear arms against the states, is going to fall. If it falls in the reasonably robust category, then I think the Chicago gun ban is going down. If it falls in the mere lip service category, then it may well be upheld. But hopefully they'll put it in the right category.
Well, certainly the way Mr. Neely describes the two categories, it's hard to be to back the mere lip service category. But I suppose that I do, although I do not think the standard here is mere lip service. I think the lesson of Lochner for most American constitutionalists and the lesson of the sort of post-New Deal court is that the courts ought to generally defer to the judgment of democratically elected legislative bodies unless there's strong evidence of bad motive or some other evidence of improper conduct. It seems to me that this is something that's distinguishes the modern urban anti-gun law from the Reconstruction era statutes. You know, when we look at these Southern statutes that we've made reference to earlier, the real purpose here is transparent. It seems to me, though, it is very hard to argue that the Chicago gun ordinance was secretly passed to try to prevent Chicagoans from resisting governmental tyranny or any other motive that the Second Amendment really inspired the Second Amendment. I think these statutes are based on a sense that we have a horrible problem with handgun violence. Something like 60 or 70 people are killed every day by handguns in the United States. And so that these, whether or not they're effective or not, these are at least good faith efforts to try to deal with a serious threat to the public's health, welfare, and safety. And as such, they fall into this long tradition of acceptable regulations of the right of firearms if the regulations are motivated by a good faith concern for protecting the public. So I don't think that that's a mere lip service category. You know, I don't think anyone has really been able to argue that there is a kind of secret agenda here that somehow is going to lead us to a police state. So I don't necessarily disagree with Mr. Neely's categories, but I do take exception to how he characterizes the category with which he disagrees.
Let me ask both of you, the New Dealers dealt with reasonableness review under Lochner by turning it into a rational basis test. And in Caroline Products, the New Deal court said laws that impinge on the First Eight Amendments that are adopted by the states may be prohibited, but everything else is upheld if there's a rational basis for it. So there still was reasonableness review, but it's highly deferential reasonableness review. I guess my question for Mr. Neely would be, since he rejects highly deferential rational basis scrutiny in this context and also in the context of Lochner, is there any guidance he could give that would prevent a situation from emerging where the federal courts become, in effect, the censors of the reasonableness of all state laws, so that there's a massive transfer in decision-making power from state government to the federal courts?
Well, I think I have two responses to that. First, I'm glad you brought up the rational basis test, because that is the distilled essence of the kind of lip service that I was talking about. I litigate rational basis cases, and I can guarantee you that the rational basis standard is nothing more than lip service for rights that the court basically feels like it has to acknowledge but wants to make clear that it's not going to protect in any meaningful way. The doctrine itself of rational basis, it has no intellectual substance or integrity. It's basically completely internally illogical if you actually analyze it. So the idea that a constitutional right is being protected by rational basis review, I think, is basically insupportable. So if you're going to be serious about a particular constitutional right, you have to apply some other standard, because that's not a serious constitutional standard. And at that point, I think what you're really asking is, well, you know, what do we do when we're dealing with constitutional rights that we actually care about? For example, free speech. Well, we require the government to have not just any reason, but a really good reason for regulating the conduct. And we also require the government to show that the law is reasonably well tailored to advancing that interest, and that there's some evidence that, in fact, the law is successful in advancing the stated interest. And I think that's where gun regulations really fall down, because the social science, which is not really something I think we want to get into too deeply today, is at best highly contestable. And it's, I think you can make a very compelling case that, for example, a complete gun ban, or at least a complete handgun ban like you had in D.C. and Chicago, may put people in at least as much danger as the proponents of those laws thinks it protects them. In other words, you're taking away guns that people might be able to use to defend themselves, and somehow that never gets counted. You're just thinking about, you know, the guns that are used in crimes. And the problem with that, or a really significant problem with that, of course, is somebody who's going to use a gun to shoot somebody or rob a bank really doesn't care that the gun itself is illegal. And that's why there's really not a shred of credible evidence, in my opinion, that gun laws have done anything to reduce violent crime, because the criminals themselves don't care about the gun laws, and they will violate them with impunity. The only people who are disarmed by these laws are law-abiding citizens who might have used that gun to protect themselves. At least that's the way I see it.
Let me follow up with Professor Hilton on this. Professor Hilton, is the reasonableness review of a right to keep and bear arms that you contemplate like what the court uses for the rational basis test in its case law, or would you do you think that more scrutiny of state laws is called for when Second Amendment rights are implicated? And in particular, if you agree with Caroline Products that more scrutiny should be given to laws for state laws that burden, say, First Amendment rights, doesn't Caroline Products also suggest that should be the case for Second Amendment rights as well?
Well, I mean, I have two problems there. One, of course, as I mentioned earlier, is the peculiar nature of the Second Amendment and the fact that it doesn't at least directly refer to the sort of core right of a kind of basic right to own firearms for self-protection or hunting or subsistence. So I'm not sure exactly how the Second Amendment fits into the Caroline Products footnote. But I do generally believe, just as an observer, that courts have probably been too differential under the rational basis review. One of the areas in which I teach is property law, right. And at least in regard to the whole area of zoning and building and variances and building permits and that whole world, I think courts have, in most jurisdictions, have exercised a more rigorous form of rational basis review. So I think it is important for the courts to at least look into questions of motive. Now, I think the point that Mr. Neely raises about effectiveness to me is more problematic. Right? When a legislature is acting in good faith on a theory that seems to be, even if contestable, at least plausible, right, that by banning handguns we'll have fewer handgun murders. If it isn't working, it seems to me that that's really more a political argument for repealing the law than it is an argument for raising it somehow to the level of constitutional restriction or kind of protected right. So I guess I don't necessarily disagree that the evidence, the social science evidence on the effectiveness of these gun laws is certainly open to question, or at least it's ambiguous as to whether or not they're really working or not. But that seems to me to be more of a political consideration, a reason to go to Chicago and campaign for the repeal of the gun law, than it is somehow an argument for ratcheting the right up to some higher level of protection.
Mr. Neely, let me follow up with a question, which is to the extent that there is a range of different possible conclusions one could reach as to what is a reasonable exercise of Second Amendment rights. Why is this not a question as to which the states should be allowed to compete with each other and experiment to some degree, or is it, in your view, potentially something where there's some room for state competition and experimentation? I was wondering if you could say something about that argument.
Well, I think there clearly is some room for state experimentation. So, for example, in almost every state, anybody who wants one can get a concealed carry permit, as long as you don't have, you know, a criminal background or a mental health problem. So that's evidence of some. And then there are other states that do make it more difficult. That's evidence of experimentation. I think the Supreme Court can and will set a baseline. In other words, you can't experiment, for example, by completely disarming everybody, which is, I think, what the issue is in Heller and McDonald. But the most fundamental response to that question is we don't allow the states to be unfettered laboratories of democracy, to use a really unfortunate and, in my opinion, inaccurate phrase, with things like law enforcement. Maybe some states think they'd catch more criminals if they could beat confessions out of suspects. We don't let them do that. Some states might think that they have, you know, a smoother and more congenial social order if they don't let people protest on street corners, and we don't let them experiment with that. So again, I think it really comes down to one's assessment of the constitutional value at stake. And, you know, the people who are really into judicial minimalism, which is sort of, I think, the thesis that Professor Hilton has been advancing, at least for Second Amendment rights and for gun control, tend to talk a lot about modesty and how important it is to be modest. Well, you know what? A modest approach to this issue is to say, well, let's try to figure out what the people who wrote the relevant constitutional provision had in mind. The relevant constitutional provision is the 14th Amendment, and what they had in mind was robust protection for the individual right to have guns in order to protect yourself. I think the history makes that ineluctably clear, and I think we ought to honor that value instead of trying to impose our own will on it.
I think we should probably finish up. Mr. Professor Hilton, did you want to make any concluding comments?
Well, let me just make a quick observation on the last point here. I mean, I think we would all, that everyone would agree, if the city of Chicago had a municipal ordinance banning citizens from owning surface-to-air missile launchers, that almost everyone would agree that the Second Amendment did not protect that, and that such an ordinance, I mean, obviously it's illegal under other statutes, but such an ordinance would be reasonable. I think, and I'm in the category of people who believe that a true ban on the ownership of all forms of firearms would be unconstitutional. So clearly someone has to draw a line somewhere between the absolute ban and a kind of absolute right to own any kind of weapon that you choose. So it seems to me at some point the drawing of a reasonable line has to be done. And so I suppose the question is, to me, is whether or not if the governmental body does that in good faith, and on the basis of some rational basis, is it appropriate for the judiciary to come in and replace the legislative judgment with a judicial judgment? And I guess on that point, I'm still skeptical, and that's why I think, even though if the drafting the Chicago ordinance had been left up to me, I certainly wouldn't have drafted it in the way that it was, particularly the punitive provisions for failing to re-register on time. But generally, you know, I think it is the proper constitutional standard to defer to legislative judgment on the Second Amendment issues, unless it's clear that the legislative body has gone, has trampled into the kind of core protected area.
Mr. Neely, did you have concluding comments?
I guess I would say this. I agree. I wouldn't have drafted the Chicago gun ordinance the way it was drafted. And focusing, for example, on that punitive, basically you're not allowed to re-register a gun if you miss the yearly annual re-registration requirement. That strikes me as really clear evidence of a very serious prejudice against gun ownership and a very clear intent to make it as difficult as possible to exercise and easy as possible to take away. So I don't think this is a case in which I would say that the government has earned any sort of deference from the courts, but that's a completely beside the point because I think the constitutional value we're talking about here is one that is enshrined in the text, and judges have to honor it whether they like it or not.
Thank you both very much, and let me just conclude by saying that I share the disappointment of both panelists today that the court didn't engage more in the oral argument yesterday with the original history from the 1860s. And with debates about the meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. But I think Mr. Neely and Professor Hilton have illustrated those issues very well for this podcast. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.